This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lefebvre, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio, filling in for Bessemer Farhat. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of ordinary people make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak at bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 8:55 to 9:50 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also log into our website at thepeoplespeakradio.com to listen to us live, join us through our live chat on Pal Talk, or listen to the archives of previous shows. We broadcast 1 hour live to the USA, UK, Canada, and Australia. If you have a question for our guest, you may call in toll-free in USA and Canada, 1-888-260-3070, or on Skype, BBS Radio. Identify your location and give a first name. Make sure to turn down your speakers or there will be feedback. And we are now toll-free. You can also listen and call via your smartphone by calling 1-712-432-0075, and when prompted, enter access code 318-1116, so you never have to miss the best guest on Internet radio. Now, tonight we're speaking with Paul Larudi, one of the American activists on board the interrupted Gaza flotilla, also Joe Metters. Jimbo Simmons of AIM will be joining us later, and Sister Pat Chafee. They were on the American ship that was in Greece to leave for Gaza, and none of the ships were ever, well, they left and were intercepted. There were several sabotage attempts, if any of you have followed this. Now, each of our guests, Paul, let's start with you, if you would like to start and tell us why you were there, when you intended to leave, and why you didn't. Paul, also we interviewed Paul last year. He was on last year's Gaza flotilla, the one where nine activists were killed on the Mavi Marmara. Hello, Paul.
Hi, it's good to be with you, Jeanette. I do want to make one small correction to your introduction, which is that we were not on the U.S. boat or American boat, and not intending to be. There were going to be two boats with Americans on it. The U.S. boat was going to have only Americans, and they did make an attempt to get into open water. Our intention was to be on the international boat, which has people of different nationalities, and we were going to be the American delegation on that boat.
Okay. Now, last year, you were on the Sfendoni, and wasn't the Sfendoni a Greek-registered ship?
It was Greek-registered. A number of the, the most of the vessels this year were leaving from Greek ports. And many of them were purchased in Greece as well.
Now, Joe, Pat, any of you may answer this. The irony struck me when I was preparing for the interview. Last year, you were on a Greek-registered ship. This year, the Greeks actively enforced the blockade of Gaza. What are your thoughts of what has made the difference in this intervening year?
Well, this is Joe. I think the thing that made the difference is the financial position that Greece is in right now. They're in a fiscal bind, and they're not going to jeopardize anything that would perhaps put any kind of financial donations to their country in jeopardy. And of course, the U.S. is going to probably donate a lot of money to them, and Israel doesn't want that to happen. So Israel probably forced the U.S. to pull some strings and have them refuse to let us depart.
I might add to that, in fact, there is a rather large exchange agreement between Israel and Greece that was going to be signed shortly. So I think that may have been part of the reason that Greece wanted to keep good relations with Israel. But I agree with Joe that certainly the U.S. had an enormous part to play in this.
And I think it might be significant to mention, too, that that it is my understanding that... Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. It's my understanding that the Greek people were very much in favor of the flotilla, and that even the Greek government, before this financial straits that they find themselves in now, were very publicly in support of Palestinian rights. So it must have been, you know, in a way difficult even for the government to have to do this, because it seems to be against their own principles that they would like to be able to uphold.
Well, as you know, in this is Paul again, in 2008, the very first two boats to go to Gaza came from Greece, were flying Greek flags. There was an immensely popular documentary in Greece that was done on this, and I was part of that effort. And after I returned from that effort, I was invited to meet with George Papandreou, who at the time he was out of power and he was in the opposition. And it was the reason he wanted to meet was basically a photo op, because this effort was so popular at the time. It's really ironic that now his government is the one that is crushing the hope of the flotilla to go to sea and to prevent the flotilla from ever reaching Gaza. But those are the political forces that take place.
Is another flotilla being planned?
In fact, it is being planned possibly for a couple of months from now, because the ships are all there. They are, in effect, ready to go. But these problems with the Greek government have to be overcome. And furthermore, the Turkish government, the IHH, the sponsoring organization of the Mavi Marmara, have declared their intention to participate in a flotilla that would leave possibly in September, for example. So the answer is that, yes, there is the declared intention to do that. The odd thing is that Israel, that didn't want the flotilla, is now in effect going to get in the news twice now, while trying to repress the flotilla, and it's going to happen another time later because the ships are still there.
Okay, I know all three of you are familiar with the law of unintended consequences. I believe Israel was hoping to avoid the kind of negative publicity they got last year through other means. I think that's fairly agreed on. But what do you see as the repercussions of this mechanism for enforcing that blockade?
Well, this is Joe. The thing that I think that might happen is the people in Greece, the people, not the government, and the people in the other nationalities or countries that were represented, are kind of upset that Israel is outsourcing its blockade, and they don't appreciate that at all. And it's highlighting the fact that that Israel will do anything to continue its blockade on Gaza. And one of the unintended consequences of the complaints that Israel filed with the Greek government is that the boats were inspected numerous times, and none of those inspections revealed any kind of munitions or armaments or any kind to be delivered to the people of Gaza. So everybody knows, the whole world knows, that we were just carrying humanitarian supplies and unarmed peaceful people, nonviolent people, to Gaza. So the Israelis had no intention of letting us go, even though we didn't have any arms or ammunition, and that was inspected. So we know why that they blockaded it.
Now, over the past year, I've been watching the events throughout the Middle East. I follow that part of the world quite closely. And there was a great deal of hope that once the Egyptians opened the Rafah crossing, that the blockade would become moot. Can any of you speak to what is happening there? Why the flotilla is still necessary with the Rafah crossing supposedly open?
I think supposedly is the key word there, because for one thing, the crossing is not open, as I understand it, to Palestinian men ages 17 to 40. So they're still stuck in Gaza. And I've read several accounts, personal accounts, of what it's like to try to cross at Rafah, that there seem to be a limited number of Palestinians allowed through, or internationals, and a limited number of people allowed through. And the accounts that I've read and heard talk about getting there and finding that they just couldn't. There was no way they were going to get through, and returning day after day. So some people are getting through, but it almost seems like before the crossing was opened, it's not a free coming and going. That's one thing. And secondly, the blockade is attacks a different aspect. It's attacking the possibility for an economic reality. Well, there is some economic growth there, as I understand it, in Gaza, but there's no trade that would come by sea. And the fishermen, the people who make their livelihood by fishing, they used to do, you know, reasonably well. They could make their livelihood, but with the blockade, they're limited to the distance they can go out prohibits them from going out into the waters where the really profitable fish can be obtained. And so they're stuck. They have to either go to the cities and become swallowed up in the slums there, or I don't know what else they can do. So those are the two things. The Rafah opening, I think, is so partial that it's dubious, and the blockade is hitting the very economy of the area.
Okay, then, is my understanding correct, because I don't always trust what I'm reading, that the Rafah crossing is essentially open to a limited number of people? It isn't open to goods. They can't ship goods through there. Essentially, it is still blockading goods.
That I don't know.
I can respond to that. And you're correct. Occasionally, the Egyptian government has allowed some things to go across. But usually when there's a land convoy of some kind and some ambulances are delivered across there and medications and things like that, it's very occasional. It's nothing like open for cargo of any kind. So, as Pat is saying, there is no economic activity that goes across that border. And even the aid is extremely limited, and usually Israel requires that aid to go into Egypt requires the aid to go into Israel first, and then from Israel into Gaza. So there's really no difference between what is happening now and what happened before, except for a slightly larger number of people that are able to exit and enter.
So what that means then is that everything that comes into and goes out of Gaza is through Israel. there's that tight control is still there.
Okay, now, my understanding is that last year, after the flotilla was taken to Israel, that they transferred all the humanitarian goods you all were carrying and said that they were going to transfer them over to the people of Gaza once they were inspected. Greece made a similar offer that they would take, if the point was to get the humanitarian aid there, that they would make arrangements to take the aid on their ships in cooperation with Israel. Can you tell me why, first of all, do we have any awareness of whether the aid that was taken last year actually went into Gaza?
Yes, in fact, it was less than about 10% of the aid that we carried in last year that went to Gaza, because most of the aid was building materials, and building materials have been almost entirely banned by Israel. Now, 10% of all the houses and buildings in Israel were destroyed or severely damaged.
In Gaza.
In Gaza, sorry. In Israel's invasion of Gaza in early 2009. And they have not been permitted to rebuild any of that. So it didn't happen at all last year. The second thing is the purpose, the amount of aid that we can deliver, even if it's 10,000 tons like it was last year, that's really a very small amount of what's required by Gaza. So our effort to bring in aid is almost a token effort. The purpose of our flotilla is to open the way by sea, to declare that this is a human rights issue, that the Palestinians have the right to receive and send goods, to travel by sea, the way everybody in the Mediterranean and around the world does, if they're a country that's on the sea. There's no reason that Palestinians shouldn't have the right to trade and travel and to harvest the sea just as much as Israelis do or any other of their neighbors, Egyptians and so forth. And that is part of what we were trying to do, that is to exercise Palestinian rights to use Palestinian waters the same way everyone else does.
Now, one of the things I've seen reported in the press, and I haven't been able to verify it, that in the intervening year, that the UN has in fact stated that the blockade of Gaza is legal. Can any of you respond to that? I'm not familiar with the details there. Is this blockade in any way legal?
Well, the only thing I can say about the legality of the blockade is that that Israel, legally speaking, has the right to prevent arms and war material from entering Gaza. That's part of international law, and it's part of an agreement that was reached with the Palestinian Authority some time ago. However, they do not have the right to prevent humanitarian aid or even just imports and exports. They don't have the right to stop anything but weapons from going into Gaza, and they're abusing their blockade rights in order to cause extreme harm and misery to the Palestinian people, and it's a part of their policy. It has been declared a part of their policy by their policy makers, especially Dov Weisglass, who represents the Prime Minister's office, who said, we're going to put the Palestinians on a diet, not so much that they die, but so that they get a lot thinner. Well, they were pretty thin to start with, using his analogy.
Another an ancillary point, I guess, to the legality of the blockade. I wasn't aware of that agreement that was made with the PLO. But the effect of that blockade is collective punishment, and the same is happening in the West Bank, that it's punishing the whole people for acts that are committed by a minority of extremists. And by the Fourth Geneva Convention, collective punishment is a war crime.
When I spoke to Ambassador Peck, who was on the flotilla with you last year, he made the comment that the blockade is illegal because the occupation is mm-hmm. illegal. And any action stemming out of an illegal action is de facto illegal.
I've been thinking about that lately, too. Well, first of all, the Israelis will say we no longer occupy Gaza. But it's not, then, my understanding is a blockade is, if this agreement with the PLO makes it legal, then I take back my argument. But my idea, my understanding is a blockade is legal if it is, occurs between two warring countries. But that's not the case here. So I don't understand the legality of the blockade myself, unless it's that agreement still holds.
Well, let's take it from this tack, and this is treading more in territory you'd be familiar with, Joe. Back in 1967, the casus belli for Israel to preemptively attack Egypt was the blockading of a single strait. Not the entire nation of Israel, not every entry and exit point. The blockading of a single strait was the reason given for the start of the 67 war. It was considered and said to be an act of war by Egypt. So how is not the blockade of an entire territory an act of war against the people of Gaza?
Well, you could make that point, argue that point quite successfully, I think. And the strait you're talking about, the Strait of Tehran back in 67, which of course brings up the USS Liberty and things that the U.S. government allows Israel to do, or allowed Israel to do with the USS Liberty, and it's a de facto policy of open season on Americans, allowing Israel to deliberately attack and totally destroy U.S. Navy ship, killing 34 Americans in the process with impunity. Not one single American member of Congress will say anything against Israel on that, even my own. And that's one of the things that brought my attention to the whole situation in the Middle East is that incident and the U.S. government's reaction to it. So I don't think Israel is really concerned about international law or anything like that. They'll do what they want to do, and the U.S. will say that's okay, regardless of what happens.
Well, I can understand Israel just running around being the bully and doing as it pleases because it's allowed to. No one has effectively stopped it. What I don't understand is why our country, like you said, Joe, ignored a deliberate, and it's obviously a deliberate attack on U.S. naval personnel, killing 34 of them. Attacks like on Rachel Corrie, which the U.S. government tends to blame Rachel, or the attack on Mavi Marmara. We now hear that there were 9 Turks killed. Let's ignore the fact that one is a U.S. citizen. These aren't the only U.S. citizens that Israel has killed over a period of time, and nationals of other nations as well. And I am... Go ahead, Pat.
Okay, I could add something to that list. I think it's immediate. The ship, the U.S. boat, is called the Audacity of Hope, as you know, and it's impounded in a military base in Piraeus, which is a port area of Athens. And this morning, or maybe it was yesterday morning, the electricity was turned off, and the temperature was over 100 degrees. There were 8 women on the boat, 4 of them over 60, and they're in this sweltering heat. And calls were made, the word went out to all of the Greek embassies, our State Department, so on. My point is they couldn't get help from the United States. That, and even from the beginning, our embassy was not available to help any of the U.S. citizens. The captain of the boat who was arrested, I'm not even sure if he ever did receive a consular visit. I'm inclined to think he did, or I'm wondering, well, how he got released. But the way all of the U.S. citizens involved in this incident were anathema to our own embassy. I understand the electricity has been turned on now. I don't know how that happened. But it's a smaller indication of what you've been saying of the these people killed with the complicity of the U.S. But I think it's the same indication of the same subservience to Israel.
But and this goes to finish the question, is why? I mean, we can speculate, yes, Greece is in horrible financial condition. They're a small country, smaller population, and they're in a wonderful position to be blackmailed and pressured economically into cooperation. But why does the USA, the most powerful nation in the world, there, Israel is not rich enough or powerful enough to pose a real threat or by itself. Why? Does anybody have an idea?
I wish I did.
Well, was it Sam Rayburn who said all politics are local? And in this case, there's a strong school of thought that it's local politics in the United States that's driving this, because there is a very powerful lobby in the United States which is well financed by a lot of the aid that's already being given to Israel, which is coming back, at least indirectly, as a form of subsidy to the Israel lobby itself. And that lobby provides funding and volunteers for most of the members of Congress, most of the elected federal offices in Washington, and they're beholden to it. So if the lobby tells Congress to jump, they usually say, how high? So that is a large part of the motive behind providing Israel with whatever it is that they're asking for.
Okay, I'm getting questions in now, and this ties in well, because essentially the U.S. citizens, now where Israel is concerned, are fair game. They have been for a long time, but I think American citizens are becoming more aware of it. So anybody wanting to help needs to know that their government will not protect them in a confrontation with Israel. So I have a young woman, Steph, in Alabama. As a recently graduated high school student, how can I help the people of Gaza? For a younger person.
Well, Seth, we'd love to hear from you. There are lots of websites, one of which is ours, the Free Palestine Movement website. You can get in touch with us, and there are volunteering opportunities. We're actually, there are lots of things that people can do to, for example, get in touch with your member of Congress, to write to your local newspaper when there's an issue regarding Israel or Palestine. These actually make a huge difference. I recall that there was a member of Congress some years ago who said that for every person who writes a letter, they assume that there are roughly 300 others who don't actually write but have the same opinion. And when they call in, it's a much larger number than that. So the power of one individual to affect Congress and through newspapers to affect public opinion is really quite a lot. And if you join an organization that presents your point of view, then you have strength in numbers as well. So there's a lot that people can do.
I'd like to second that to become part of an organization like Free Palestine Movement, and there are others too. And one of the big things about that is you can get, this is for the high school girl, you get suggestions of things to read. I think it's important to be informed so that you can support your arguments.
Another thing to do is to visit Gaza yourself and see what's going on and to help the people there, you know, living daily lives. The only exposure people in the States have about Palestine is the YouTube videos that you see of confrontations with the Israelis and demonstrations and all that stuff. You don't see the normal, everyday Palestinian family just trying to make ends meet and how they do that. There's no way that you can see how they go about doing that. A good organization to get involved with in that regard is the International Solidarity Movement, which is PalSolidarity.org. They sponsor people into Gaza to see for themselves and to help the Palestinians.
Another site that might be able to facilitate that is Code Pink.
Okay. Yes, I've spoke to Code Pink, and in fact, we invited members of the Shemina STEM who were here in the USA speaking to on the show, the 12th graders in Israel who refused to serve in the military.
Ah, yes, yes.
And I found out about them through Code Pink. So yes, there's a lot of valuable organizations, and with the internet available to everybody, it's easy to find a group that you can support ethically and in good conscience. Something else, the condition being is that anybody getting involved with the Palestinians, whether it be here in the USA or in Gaza, as we've stated, are now out seemingly from under the protection of the American government. And that's a risk that anybody wanting to get involved, whether they go to Gaza and risk their life or risk, you know, friends and family here within the USA, this is a risk. Paul, you've encountered the Israelis more than once. In fact, that was one of the things I've wondered is how you are still alive.
I hope it's due at least in part to the fact that that all of us are engaged in nonviolent resistance, and that this removes some of the reason for taking even more drastic measures than have been done. I was hurt physically last year, but I didn't receive any broken bones, and there were people who did have broken bones, and worse, as we know, 9 people were killed last year. But I have no way of knowing for sure to what extent that contributes to the fact that I'm still alive. But I would have to say that in response to what you said earlier, there are people in the United States who have never left the United States, and a large number of them, who are in some jeopardy from U.S. policy towards Israel as well. So that, for example, recently the Supreme Court decided that teaching an organization that is considered a terrorist organization by the U.S. government, teaching them nonviolence and nonviolent techniques, which is what another U.S. organization did, is a type of aid or assistance or material support to that organization, which puts in jeopardy any sort of contact with any of these peoples. So people in the United States, for example, can write a letter or make some kind of contact with organizations that have that send humanitarian aid from other countries, but are not allowed to do so from the United States, and they can find themselves in violation of the law. So it's anyone the right to give aid to other countries to people in need is in jeopardy for all Americans. You just don't know. We basically have to live in fear of what our government might do to us.
And do to us on behalf of another foreign government. This I find disturbing. In fact, when Benjamin Netanyahu was before Congress, and our Congress stood and applauded the man, at the same time they're excoriating our own president publicly in the press, I find disturbing.
Well, the most ironic thing about Netanyahu was that he was justifying the settlements in the occupied territories. Our official policy towards those settlements is that they are illegal and an obstacle to peace. And yet, when he said there's nothing illegal about about our settlements, our members of Congress stood up and applauded a statement that was blatantly against U.S. policy.
That's also against the third Geneva Convention about an occupying country settling in the occupied areas.
Transfer of civilian population into occupied zones is a violation of the Geneva Conventions.
Yeah.
Transferring civilian population out of an occupied zone is equally a violation. And Benjamin Netanyahu was on record in 1988 as advocating the transference of all Palestinians out.
Right.
I don't think he's really changed his opinion.
Now,
as I was saying, the events of the intervening year, the uprisings throughout the Middle East, to what degree do you think this is going to force Israel to adjust its strategy in dealing with the Palestinians and the international community? I know that it had them very, very concerned.
That was one of my concerns when they started the Arab Spring. What happens if the people of Palestine rise up and try to overthrow Hamas and get a more democratic, more acceptable to the U.S. government in there, and they, like the rebels in Libya, fall behind, and Hamas starts defeating them? Do we send in troops into Gaza to help them overthrow Hamas? And what would Israel do with at that time?
Well, more my concern is that as these Arab nations, the people take control from these governments that have been in the pocket of the U.S., and their policy towards the Palestinians is heavily influenced by the U.S., what is going to happen to these policies if they are replaced by the governments that are friendlier to the Palestinians? Because, again, these are governments. The people of the Middle East have never been anti-Palestinian. We hear a lot of that. Oh, you know, they're helping. No, it's their governments influenced by the USA that have aided and abetted Israel, not the people themselves. And as the people throughout the Middle East tend to start pushing, have you any indication that there would be a...
Jeanette, I think it's wrong to place much hope on any replacement government, no matter how much they're improved. In the past, there were governments that, even if they weren't necessarily very democratic, that really, I mean, they went to war for the Palestinians, and they failed. So I can't imagine that things are going to change very much for Palestinians on the basis of government changes. On the other hand, I do think that the the fact of people at the grassroots level feeling that they have more power, I think that will have a bigger effect. In fact, I'm hoping in less than 2 weeks from now to go to a conference. It's the fourth meeting of a group that is trying to get, would you believe, 1 million people to march to Jerusalem from across all the borders of Palestine, and to do this in a nonviolent, peaceful way, using the kind of people power that we saw in Egypt and Tunisia and other places. So this is the kind of potential that this brings up, and that is going to, and we don't know where that can lead to, but we know what happened with people power and the power of people around the world in South Africa. It changed everything, and we hope that that might be able to happen in this case.
Okay, now we've got less than 10 minutes left, and I have three. Oh, no, I think I lost the caller. But I have some other questions from callers. I'm sorry about that. I'm still learning this Skype. And you have my apologies for last week. That was my Skype. Let me pull up these other questions. From Mike in California, for any of the guests, do any of you feel that the USA, via the State Department, is guilty of endorsing the sabotage and the violence against the flotilla with its recent disapproval and condemnation of Americans participating in the flotilla? Did that?
I would say yes. You know, if they sit back and they do nothing when they should be investigating it, that moves them from endorsing it to actually condoning it. They're actually committing the war crimes instead of just advocating for it.
Okay, now the next question before we run out of time: do any of the guests think that even though they were unsuccessful in going to Gaza, that the attention may help focus attention on Gaza, especially considering the Palestinian plea for the recognition this fall in the UN? And since you mentioned that September was the planning for when they would like to try to sail again, that coincides with the intention of Palestinians before the UN.
I sometimes wonder the fact that we didn't sail and had so much media attention, if almost we didn't gain more than we would have had we sailed. Medea Benjamin has an excellent article on common dreams, and she points out about how Israel's outsourcing of the blockade to Greece, of how that backfired on them through the publicity that we got. I think in a way we were successful.
Okay.
If you want to put it in the win or lose terms, the only way Israel could have won was to let us go to Gaza.
That's right.
Unhampered.
Mm-hmm.
But the way they did it now, we've gained all sorts of publicity, and the world is staying awake to the plight of the Palestinians.
Okay, we got our caller back. This is Lily from Michigan. Go ahead, Seth.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. I don't really understand the Palestinian and Israel situation. Is the flotilla's purpose to bring aid or to break the Israeli blockade?
Break the blockade.
The purpose really is to assert Palestinian human rights. So in that sense, it's the purpose. Hello?
Hello, did we lose you?
Hello?
I'm here. I think we're getting some feedback. But in any case, the purpose is, in fact, to break the blockade. We don't want to go empty-handed, and that's why we're taking aid. But we recognize that the aid is really just a token amount. And it's the principle that we're trying to exercise, namely the right of Palestinians to receive both people and goods, cargo, humanitarian aid in this case, by sea, and for them to travel and use sea. So it's really about their rights more than it is about getting large quantities of aid into Gaza.
Okay, we're down to 3 minutes now. I would like each one of you to give us one final comment on what your future plans are to assist or to continue your activism with Gaza.
I'll just mention that in my case, we saw that right at the end of the flotilla mission, there was what's being called the flytilla into Israel. This was an effort, and it was stopped to a large degree by Israel, but not to Israel's advantage. Again, Israel comes across as being very autocratic and downright cruel in terms of its treatment towards Palestinians and their friends. I think that the international community is mobilizing more and more and more, and it's not going to be stopped by repressive measures like this. I think that the measures of citizens like the three of us and all the others who are involved in the flotilla will increase in number and in size, and that eventually Israel will have to adjust its policy.
And my intentions are to continue to educate. I use every chance I have to speak to groups and to write and to respond to any, to let my congresspeople know, although that doesn't do a whole lot of good, but at least they know where I stand whenever there's an issue that comes up. And certainly if I have the opportunity and can afford it, to, as we say, next year, Gaza, to go to Gaza again. I have been in Gaza, and that's my main reason for being on this flotilla, is that I've been there. I was there 5 months after the invasion by Israel, and I saw the devastation and heard the anguish of the people there. And so, yes, if I have the opportunity and can afford it, I will return.
Okay, and Joe?
My plans are basically the same as everybody else's, to continue educating the American people on the situation in Palestine, and in my particular case, just go to Gaza for an extended stay and learn firsthand how they live and what they have to put up with and how they survive from day to day, and bring that back to the States and educate people on the human side of the Palestinian.
Okay, well, I want to thank all three of you for being here with us tonight, Paula Rudy, Joe Metters, and Sister Pat Chafee, members who attempted this last flotilla to Gaza. Next week, our time is up. Next week, the show will be with Bessema Farhat returning, and her guest will be Ward Churchill, the controversial educator, author, artist, activist. So please return next week from 8:55 to 9:55, or 9:55. Well, never mind. I just got lost. I don't do that often. So good night, everyone. And thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In the shadow of the stable, by the relief on the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.